climate changes. And we'll also talk about those aspects that will likely never change. We get into all of that this hour on the Kenai Conversation with my guest, Dr. Alan Boris.
What would sort of be your kind of boilerplate definition when we talk about a culture of the North? What does that mean sort of in broad terms?
Well, we're used to looking at maps that portray North America on one side, and distant, far away is Europe and Asia and so on. If you look at a polar projection, however, the North becomes clearer. I have a map in my office of a polar projection, and I look at it frequently to give me a perspective. So we're close. Alaska is close to Scandinavia, certainly close to northern Canada, not far from Russia. Sarah Palin was probably right about that. And it's true. So what do we share? Obviously, we share the climate. Climate's changing, but nevertheless, we share a climate of the North. In particular, we share the light of the North. And in that regard, we can share it with the South, as the Deep South. I mean South Pole as well. But the light is really one of our defining characteristics. We're coming on the dark season. And as everyone knows, in the summer, it's light. What a lot of people don't seem to think of is that we have the same amount of light as Miami. Just comes in different amounts, different times of the year. So it's the light and the landscape. And I think in terms of the North, the other thing we have is a closer affinity and a closer history with Indigenous people. And through that, understanding what it takes to adapt to a place sustainably over long periods of time. There are Indigenous peoples in the North in Scandinavia, but not anymore in Southern Europe, and so on.
I definitely want to talk about sort of how the cultures relate to one another as the North has developed and has been developed. But before that, I want to talk especially, because what struck me as an idea to talk about this this time of year is that we are starting to slowly turn into that very dark time, and maybe not as cold as people remember, but it's turning into winter here. And so when we talk about that difference in light, the coldness, traditionally at least, the snow and all of these things, how does that contribute to a culture of the North? Is the light and the sort of the conditions singularly what makes it its own culture?
It contributes to it. So it's probably easiest to understand in terms of colonial occupation of the North. I maintain that in addition to people coming for economic reasons, people have brought a mid-latitude culture with them, mid-latitude values, mid-latitude perspectives. And the seminal statistic for our times is that 80% of my generation, and a little younger, were not born here nor were raised here.
And you're a baby boomer, right?
I'm a baby boomer. I am the first wave of baby boomers, yes. So that means that whole homesteading and then oil, massive movement, overwhelming the Indigenous people in that sense. It wasn't until, I believe it's 1944, that the non-native population exceeded the native population in Kenai relatively late. And then large numbers came. Now, just as an aside, this coming weekend, the Ballot of Kenai will be presented. People shouldn't come to that thinking it's a happy, singing in the rain, kind of wonderful, how glorious Kenai is and was. It's really about this issue of people coming and people having been here, pay attention to the character of Robert, and pay attention to who stays. So the other part of that is that now 80% of the millennial generation, or whatever you wish to call it, say 40 and below, age 40 and below, are from here, or were significant, either born here or significantly raised here. We will never have that condition again. We will never have that situation in Alaska, that disparity in generations. So the younger generation, let's say, we'll call it that, really has a question. Both generations have questions. For the younger folks, it's why stay? We are brought up, conditioned to think of success in terms of major cities and major places. Success is, you know, it's the old song about New York. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. I don't think that's true. In fact, I think that's the perception.
We like to think that's true.
Exactly. It's the perception, or California, or, you know, wherever. But generally, Alaska is not included in the cool places to be a success or to live. I was just talking with some folks, two different groups that have just been to Portland. Portland's the new cool city if you're younger. They come and they go, but now it seems to be Portland. It's the hip place. You know, a lot of good young restaurants and activities and blah, blah, blah. So why stay? Now, for my generation, the question's a little different. It's, where's home? We came from somewhere, usually, or sometimes on a lark, sometimes for whatever reason, sometimes for work, but somewhere along the line, we begin to ask, why are we living in this northern place so distant from relatives, so distant from a home that we really didn't experience before? It's not like moving from Iowa to Wisconsin. It's not the same. You know, weather-wise, light-wise, otherwise, it's generally similar. But to move to Alaska or to move back away from Alaska is a very significant thing. Even though with, you know, modern technology, we have a lot of ways of communicating, but still, face-to-face at a place is the fundamental communication of life. So where's home? And I know that's an important question because I once gave I was a fill-in sermon at the Methodist Church a number of years ago. And I even got to stand in the pulpit. That was so cool. I talked about that concept, where's home? And there were a lot of tears in the audience, because it is a meaningful question to people. So how does that relate to the North? So and I'm talking now about those who came here, generally have not come to embrace the North as much to transpose onto the North a mid-latitude culture and a mid-latitude perspective. Soldotna is an archetype, a case in point of building a town, not a northern town, but building in a northern place a midwestern town. It's strip malls, it's, you know, it's got all those things, it's got all the elements of that lower 48 town.
I always look at Seward as the prime example with their nice, neat Jeffersonian grids and president names one way and alphabet the other way. And
well, exactly. And, you know, we can chart the towns of the peninsula. That was a railroad town, so it was in this little grid. Now we have highway towns. Kenai's a highway town. Soldotna's a highway town. Homer's become a highway town as well. So we've imposed this. And what we also have brought are something that I would refer to as mid-latitude values or mid-latitude perspective. And that comes in the metaphors we use to understand the place. So I want to talk a little bit about what metaphor means in this. It's ways we understand the reality that's around us, but it's symbolic and subconscious. So one of the things we have brought, I maintain, is the subconscious notion that cold and dark are metaphors of evil. So I knew we were going to talk about this. So I went to a biblical concordance. There are 215 references to cold and dark in the Bible as evil.
That's a substantial enough number to say that I think that would be decided that those two things represent evil and to a certain faith.
Well, I'm not done yet. There are 208 references to light and warm as good. So metaphors. Here's some common metaphors that are used. Frosty relations, hiring freeze, cool reception, cold war, cold-blooded murder. All of these cold references to something bad. Shakespeare used the phrase cold as a dead man's nose. So it pervades literature, pervades movies, you know, the classic, there's a reason Darth Vader wore black, the good guys wore white. The question isn't, is there evil? The question is, what's the best metaphor to describe something we perceive as evil? And I would maintain that cold and dark are not good metaphors in the North. We have brought the wrong metaphors north. Because it's cold and dark a lot of the time. That's not a bad thing. Cold is simply the absence of heat. Dark is simply the absence of light. They are physical properties that we give meaning to that can be construed as good. A lot of people love the northern light, and artists are beginning to capture that. Or we can construe them as bad, in which case they are a misplaced metaphor.
Talking about the Northern Lights is one thing that we sort of celebrate as being unique to this part of the world and by extension the cultures who inhabit this part of the world. What are some other things, or are there other things that celebrate the darkness, celebrate the cold, celebrate those things that do make it a gnarly place to live relative to most other places?
I was doing a little trip around the internet, probably some night when I couldn't sleep, and I ended up, internet-wise, vicariously, in Scandinavia, looking at plays they present outside in winter. So they've got a little outdoor theater. Everybody brings their sleeping bag and their whatever flask they want to warm up with, and they have plays. They have movie nights. And so, you know, it's embracing the North, the cold. We're starting to do that here. Soldotna, you know.
Frozen River Fest, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Who'd have thought 10 years ago that would happen in Soldotna? Frozen River Fest and also those movie nights.
They sure.
Show some movies and same thing. People bring their sleeping bags and warm clothes, and it's a way to embrace the North. Sports. embracing the North. Obviously, cross-country skiing and related sports, hockey, although hockey's largely indoor now, but embracing this cold, dark season as opposed to indoor sports. And I used to coach cross-country skiing. I know I heard other coaches, why would kids want to go outside when it's cold and dark in the winter? Well, it's not cold if you're generating heat. You're this little bundle of energy moving through. It's a remarkable feeling, and it's really not dark either. You go out, it's dark when you look out toward the outside from inside. Nothing is darker and foreboding. But you step outside with the right gear, and all of a sudden your eyes adjust, and it's a remarkable place. So those are two that come to mind, sports and theater.
Right.
And outdoor activities, and it's the opposite of shutting down in winter. And we won't become that northern place. We, and I mean Alaska, particularly South Central Alaska, won't become that northern place with the sanity that goes with it until we really embrace it as for what it is. So to go back to the obviously seasonal affective disorder, cabin fever, they're real things, but I believe that they're largely influenced by the metaphors we live by. Change the metaphor and you change the perception of the place. Native Alaskans, so Dena'ina, for example, they had a metaphor of evil. It wasn't cold and dark. Metaphor of evil was an unpredictable brown bear. Not the predictable bear, you know, the one that's ambling along and you kind of shy away from it, but it's that angry brown bear that's evil. That's evil. You could add a moose to that too, an angry moose, which, you know, if you've been charged by a moose, you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the types of things that the metaphor, the stories, would use as metaphors of evil.
You're talking about, you know, there's biblical references to light and dark and evil and those sorts of things, but are you seeing those metaphors change in any way? I mean, there is that sort of, you know, a broad sort of religious undertone to certain things, but in specifics, do you see things change? Or is there at least some recognition of traditionally what has been a marker of those kinds of concepts?
I think they're changing slowly. You see it in literature. I mean, there's a emerging, it's, you know, not emerging like in the last 20 years or so, more of a literature of the North that's a little more sophisticated than it has been. A lot of writers are grappling with this. The occasional TV show, Northern Exposure was one of them, but I don't know if...
Now, the reality shows are really what piques people's interest. I didn't understand it really until I had spent a winter here and then gone back home.
Iowa, right?
To Iowa, right. Back to the Midwest, the mid-latitude place, right? And then you get the questions, what's it like up there? How do you deal with the darkness? And you don't really, I guess, unless you're back and forth, you lose that perspective a little bit. It's not a, it's just something that you deal with because you have to deal with it. It's, you know, you get out and just get out during the day when it's dark, you know? Yeah.
Well, that's the reality of it.
Right.
And when, for example, metaphors don't match reality, then there's a problem. The reality shows, I don't watch them. I've you know, watched 15 minutes once or twice just to see what they're about, and they're actually not reality shows. They're creating a mythology of the North that never really, that isn't here and never has been here, but people seem to like to watch it.
It's very romanticized.
Yeah.
And I don't think that, you know, if we're talking about a meeting of cultures, if we're talking about European cultures, more southerly cultures coming to the north, that, you know, that's never been a romantic relationship. The cooperation, I have to imagine the cooperation that you would see between those two countries is based on a simple need for survival and nothing else.
Probably, yeah. I would say one of the more significant events that has happened on the Kenai Peninsula that has emerged, reflecting that northern focus and primarily being generated from a millennial generation, is Salmon Fest. Who'd have thought that, I don't know, you get a lot of people. People would descend on Nanilchik, Alaska in August to celebrate salmon. Rock bands. I remember going to the second one, and I'm watching, and rain's coming down. It's just pelting down rain, and the band's up there rocking away, and young people, mostly young people, young to me anyway, dancing in extra tufts and Helly Hansen gear and just rocking away.
Uh-huh.
And why? And it's a celebration of the North. Artwork, T-shirts, you know, all of this is beginning to celebrate the North as its own place, not as an extension of Seattle, not as an extension of Washington, not as an economic thing to be exploited, not celebrating, as our newly elected governor has said, an extractive economy, but celebrating wild salmon and the realization that wild salmon have mostly gone away just about everywhere except Alaska. And now we have a challenge. So I think it's a remarkable event, and events like that are springing up. A transition to becoming a culture of the North, as they are happening in Scandinavia, as they are happening in Russia and in northern Canada. It's kind of been this universal thing. I think the other countries are way far ahead of us. Scandinavia had its northern migration 100 years ago. Canada more recently. I don't know about Russia. But it will have to happen if we are going to survive. We are going to have to embrace the North, embrace the landscape, embrace the weather, embrace the climate, and especially embrace the light.
With respect to, you know, keeping cultures alive, those are such generational questions. What, you know, values of one generation against values of another. And I'm so curious, you know, from your experience as an educator here, how have you seen that change? And you know, you talked about specifically the millennials as being perhaps a bit more open to the millennial generation being a bit more open to finding those more traditional methods and means and seeking out more sustainable ways. Do you see that as being true? Have you seen that change with generations of students?
It's tough to be a millennial. I thought it was tough to be a baby boomer, but it's real tough to be a millennial. Yeah, I have. But underlying all of this is why stay? That question of why stay. Where am I going to put down these roots? So let's take somebody who was born here, raised here, and they see that developing some kind of culture of the North, even though they might not put it in those terms, is something they want to do. It's a whole lot easier to move to Portland. It's already there. It doesn't have the northern component, but it does have that youth culture. On the other hand, people are fascinated, let's say. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. When he was still alive, so this was quite a while ago, Peter Kalifornsky and I went to Kalifornsky Beach Elementary, just down the road from the college here. And his book had just come out, so this was 1991. And they were having some kind of awards day. I don't remember the details, but the principal was there. I think a superintendent was there, and lot of dignitaries, and the whole school was sitting on the bleachers, on the risers of the school in the gymnasium. So you get, I don't know, 300 kids. They make a lot of racket. Peter and I were to present one of his stories from his book, and I look at the program, and they said the Pledge of Allegiance. So I went to the superintendent of schools. I said, hey, look, Peter and I will do the Pledge of Allegiance, because he had written that in his book. He'll say the first line in Dena'ina, and I'll say the English, and we'll work through it that way. He said, no, that won't work, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, I said, no, we're going to do it. So we did. So the kids are rattling, you know, they're at assembly, they're punching one another and pulling pigtails and whatever kids do. I don't know if they still do that. They probably do. Peter starts out with the first line in Dena'ina of, I pledge allegiance to the flag. And they didn't know what it meant, but then I said it. And it got quieter and quieter and quieter. Here's this old man, native man, speaking a language of the place. And we got done, and all hell broke loose again, and they're rattling and talking. And then it came time for and I forget which story we read, same thing happened. As he talked, got quieter, and people were third graders, first graders, sixth graders, listening intently, even their teachers. Afterwards, I'm standing talking to somebody, and I look over, and there's about 50 kids standing in front of Peter, reaching their hand out, and he's touching them, one after the other, and then off they would go. Symbolically, I believe, demonstrating that he had something they wanted to know about. He had something that was connected to the place where they were born, where they were raised, where that they were missing.
Right, all those things true and yet still totally foreign at the same time.
Exactly. Didn't know what it was, didn't know the language, but knew that he was the key. He was a key to understanding the place they lived. And I'll never forget that particular memory. So what is it that now people growing up are still searching for those understandings of the place where they live and their northern perspectives? They're not something you're going to find in media or literature or anywhere else. It's in the land, it's in the people, it's in the climate, it's in the light. And it's starting to happen. The leaders of the communities need to embrace those ideas, need to allow for this northern culture to develop and not just say, well, you know, I'm going to retire in 4 years. I'm going back to wherever Colorado, and they pick a spot. I'll have my retirement. I'm not vested in this place. What should I care? It's a extraction economy anyway. That's disaster. It needs to be embraced for what it is, a northern place of northern people.
As you're talking about ways to embrace this northern culture, I guess I'm kind of stuck on a sort of practical application of that and thinking, you know, about how we spend our time in the winter and how we maintain our physical and mental health in the winter, because that can be difficult in a modern society in the north. I think of it sort of in those terms. Is that a healthy way to think of it?
Totally. I mean, it's critical. Here's what you do. Not you, but winter's unpredictable. So I'll have in my car, I'll have my skis. Actually, I'll have two types. I'll have track skis, and I'll have bushwhacking skis. The land opens up in the swamps in the winter, in ways that it doesn't do in the summer. The Dena'ina knew this. The trails, the winter trails, are all across the swamps and so on. So I've got two pair of skis. I've got ice skates. I mean, we had some great ice skating about a week and a half ago.
For a couple of days there, it looked pretty good.
For a couple of days. And it will happen again because there's a progression in how the lakes freeze. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Ski Lack and Testamina Lake won't freeze until after New Year's. So keep the skates there because, you know, it might be that day when you can go out. Spiked running shoes or walking shoes, whatever. And it doesn't have to all, you can have the spiked kind, you have the regular kind. And snowshoes. So you've got all this with you. And you've got a headlamp. And you've got varying degrees of clothes that you can put on at work or wherever. And what does the day bring you? It's not about planning your own activities, it's adapting to the day. What will the day bring you? Because you can do one of those activities every day, even if it's just walking, and walking is still one of the best. You can ski, you can ice skate, you can snowshoe. All of these things you can do, and so the day revolves around, for many people, the work day and what they're doing, and then that hour or whenever when they can break away, maybe it's before supper, maybe it's after supper, maybe whenever, but that time to get outside and move on the landscape. So it's recreation, but it's really more than recreation. It is critical to health and survival and mental health in the North. And it's not hard. There's an old Swedish proverb that says there's no bad weather, only bad gear. So,
is that an old Swedish proverb or is that an ad for REI?
it actually is a Swedish proverb.
Okay, okay.
They actually say there's no bad weather, only bad clothes.
Right.
Which is the same thing. So, you know, you got the right stuff. And knowing how to use it, that's another important part. Because it's not just throwing on expensive gear, and it doesn't have to be expensive. When I helped build the Salteshi ski trails, I was very clear in my mind that what we were doing was building a culture of the North, a place that is near populated areas where people, after work or whenever, can go out and 45 minutes, hour, get a good workout, enjoy the landscape, enjoy the terrain, enjoy the winter, and then go home and enjoy their family, preferably building a fire and enjoying it. So that's part of life in the North. It isn't to shut down in the winter because it's cold and it's dark and be have that foreboding of the North that is too much embedded in literature and other things, and in just the folk wisdom, misplaced folk wisdom. Embrace it. You got no other choice except move to Kansas.
And to some people, that's quite a prospect.
It is that's part of mm-hmm. that where's home.
Yeah.
Where's home? It's a lot easier to live in Oregon than it is to live here in many ways. I mean, the other day we had bad weather, hard to drive, it was icy. You know, you probably did the road reports.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you just adapt to it and be smart about it. And if you can, you stay home.
You and I have talked about time in the North and as it relates to Native cultures in particular, but as it relates to a more general culture of the North, I'm starting to wonder if, and I'll tell you where I'm coming from, is when I first moved up here, and I haven't been here that long, I moved up in late November, and the immediate thing that I noticed was how slow everything seemed to be. Not in much of a hurry. It was very dark. It was cold. Things just seemed to really slow down. And that seems to be just sort of a natural function. And I'm curious if you think that that's sort of a natural function of just the place. And if that If that, you know, if the darkness and those sorts of things are sort of a natural limit to how much the culture can change?
That's a hard one to answer, but I would look at it this way. I think everybody should go winter camping. And I don't mean driving out and, you know, taking your, or going out on a snow machine. I mean pulling a sled, snowshoes, skis, whatever you got, multiple days. And that's not a relaxing time. It's not like, oh, la-di-da. It's 'cause your mind is continually monitoring how your body's doing, how your skis are doing, where you're going to set up camp, how you're going to get firewood, in particular, where you're going to get water, if you've got your dog with, and you should, how your dog's doing, which way the wind is blowing, what's blowing in or not blowing in, weather changes, climatic, you know, whatever is happening. It is a very focused time, at least it has been for me, and I would maintain it's for everyone who would choose to do that. So the time you're talking about is sort of Western culture time. And I guess it varies for people, you know. For me, winter is a very busy time. I teach. I got projects I got to do. I got stuff I've got to accomplish. And don't think because you're a college professor, it's just, you know, you gotta produce something. It's not, you know, it's like being on a professional basketball team. You don't score any points. You're not on the team.
That's right.
The same thing for me. So summer is actually the time for me when I can slow down a little. I think it varies. I don't think there's anything automatic, I guess is what I'm saying, about the north and cold and dark being a time to slow down. Some people, yes. Other people, no.
You mentioned earlier how as the landscape changes in the winter, that opens more things up. And so there are sort of built-in ways to not let that be the case.
Absolutely. The traditional Denaina, as I say, had trails covered. It basically covered the swampy areas where now they're frozen and you can snowshoe, now you can ski or cover them in other ways. The other thing, traditionally, for Denaina, it was time of visiting. Whole villages would up and move, 200-300 people, on a trail system to another village and stay for a couple of weeks. This was not an uncommon thing, and sometimes even crossing the inlet, which was really tricky. On the other side of the inlet, moving up Lake Clark Pass, visiting. So it was a time when you did things, but a little different than strict subsistence activities. It was also a time when usually it was men by themselves would go out for months sometimes to trap, because winter is the trapping time. Build a sort of a lean-to and spend their days comfortable with themselves. So there's another dimension of being in the north, to be able to be comfortable with yourself in those cold conditions and dark conditions.
Being comfortable with yourself and very much a part of what, you know, you're talking about, basically, you know, being kind of isolated and tough to get around and these sorts of things. But conversely, it's also very true that the winter offers a great time for socializing, and that's a very important part of this of a northern culture, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's
any culture.
Any culture, exactly. For traditional Denaina, summer was busy fishing, essentially, and storing and fish. And the same is true today. A lot of people are busy getting food in, fishing. And it's amazing how, especially with the dip net fishing, how that has sort of taken hold as a way for people to get food that they don't have to have, but perceive that if you're going to live in the North, you need to partake of.
Mm-hmm.
So fishing is, and you know, winter activities have kind of defined the place. So some of the most iconic photos of fishing on the Kenai Peninsula are those pictures you see of a man or a woman holding up a big fish. So I think part of what that's about, aside from advertising for guides, if it's a guide, is trying to answer the question of why live here. People move. They come north. They don't really think of it as coming north, but more of a sort of this adventure, probably a couple years, maybe four, and they'll go back home. But life happens. They stay longer, and at some point they sort of have to face where they're going to spend the bulk of their adult life. And sometimes there's pressure from home. It happened in my life. I remember my mother asking me, when are you going to move home? And I had to tell her that I didn't think I was ever going to move back to northern Minnesota, and I'm glad I didn't, but it was hard for her. Other people, trying to justify why you live in this remote place. And I think that photo is a way to answer that question, because you can't do that kind of thing in Missouri. Well, catfish maybe, but it isn't the same. In other words, it's being able to do activities that are close to the land that are not typical of other places in the lower 48, and embrace at least momentarily that wild landscape. Now, the thing about the Kenai River is it's just wild enough to be wild, but not so wild that it takes some real serious skill. I've been on the Mulchatna River. That takes some serious skill. You don't have any help. You're out there by yourself. I've been on the Nooshigak River. Takes some serious skill. You can't just call 911 and get some help. It's true wilderness in that sense. But either way, it's a way of expressing in a photograph why we live in the North. For a lot of people.
Because there's nothing more sort of resounding of an answer of this is why than to be standing next to a barn door halibut.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And it's so it's so interesting because, and especially in talking about younger folks, millennials in particular, that is a huge part of the millennial generation. You think about Instagram as being a major part of that age of the culture, and specifically wanting to project to the outside world this version of yourself that almost exclusively engages in activities that are tough to do or not everybody can do every day or whatever the case may be, that are special in some way. That's really interesting.
That's a really good point. And, you know, that new way of defining oneself through selfies, I mean, the selfie
right.
image. I'm not quite up to the selfie, but almost every year when I go skating, ice skating on the lakes, I take a picture of my feet, you know, my skating on the ice, and I'm into the sound and so on. And a lot of people say, wow, cool, that's so awesome. And it's my way of saying this is a remarkable place, and I'm part of it. And I intend to stay part of it.
We're getting down to almost an hour here. I wanted to talk a little about you know, sort of looking ahead. And we know how drastically the climate, especially in the North, is changing. Looking at it from sort of a cultural aspect, I'm curious what you think are the aspects of a Northern culture that are, on the one hand, most likely to remain intact and possibly even thrive in a warmer world, and which aspects are most likely to perhaps fade away if they're not properly cultivated and remembered?
Well, this is a bigger issue than we think. The recent migration of people out of Honduras and that President Trump milked for a lot of political reasons.
The caravan. Yeah, yeah.
Those have been going on for years.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a new thing. In the Middle East, Syria, moving, in this case, into Europe.
Climate refugees,
exactly. They're moving north. They're moving north not because, oh, they want to be Americans. They're not moving north because they, you know, oh, I just love to work a menial job. They're moving north because they can't feed themselves anymore, because their fields are burning up, and they're starving. So we're going to feel the brunt of that in Alaska if things keep going the way they are. Now, I will welcome them myself because they're coming from horrible conditions, and I hope we embrace them because we will become that temperate latitude if things keep going. The vegetation's going to change slightly. We'll probably see more elm trees and maple trees growing. I understand they're trying to grow redwoods in Homer. Probably succeed at it. So populations will shift north. That's what's going to happen. They won't if we can do something to stem the tide of anthropogenic population climate change. And we can do that. We have the knowledge of how to do that. We have the technology of how to do that. We don't have the political will. Petrochemical-based energy is going to wane. Germany is, I forget what it is, in 10 years, they're going to go to all electric cars. Norway, same kind of agenda. A lot of countries are going to significantly reduce their carbon footprints. The United States isn't on board with that, and we better be. Even China is making noises of reducing its carbon footprint. So that's the story. The North will change dramatically because of climate change. Not so much in terms of the climate, but in terms of the people that will come here to try to make a living because they can't where they're from. I mean, I'll miss it. I'll miss the ice. I'll miss skiing. I'll miss a lot of things. But I also know that the natural world follows cycles. And if we can get back to those natural cycles of cold and warmer, cold and warmer. It's called the Pleistocene. Then we'll be all better off. But in the meantime, we're just going to have to adapt to it.
What would, just to kind of close out, maybe on a slightly brighter note,
what?
and also to boil this down, again, this notion of a culture of the North into a way more simplistic thing than it really is, what would you point to as sort of singularly unique and important an aspect of a Northern culture that is sort of projected out into the world? Is that the ability to simply live sustainably in a harsh climate? Is it as simple and broad as that, or is there something more specific?
First of all, I wouldn't use the term harsh climate. It's a pretty nice climate, in my opinion. I like the cold. As I forget which one, Anna or Elsa says in the movie Frozen, the cold doesn't bother me anyway.
That's right.
I don't know. It's a combination of those things. It's the climate. It's the dramatic difference between winter and summer. It's the landscape, largely unmodified landscape. And more than anything, I think it's the light. And putting all those things together, that's the north. The changes in light, I mean, that's the north. And it's a remarkable place. It's a place that a lot of people can't live. They can take it for a while, but they can't or won't. But I think it's, to me, it's home, and it's what I love. So I'm here for the long haul.
Well, thanks for being with us today for a little while. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having me.